In the context of this year's Parnell Summer School, we've spent a lot of time this week talking about John F. Kennedy, and it's perhaps fitting that we conclude our look at the late president by examining the events of the 22nd of November 1963. This is how CBS reported on that day.
There has been an attempt, as perhaps you know now, on the life of President Kennedy. He was wounded in an automobile driving from Dallas Airport into downtown Dallas, along with Governor Connally of Texas. They've been taken to Parkland Hospital there, where their condition is as yet unknown. We have not been told their condition. At Dallas, in the downtown hotel room, a group had been gathered to hear President Kennedy when he was waiting his arrival. From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
The famous Walter Cronkite, the CBS anchorman making the announcement that changed America. Interestingly, another famous CBS anchorman, Dan Rather, was one of the first to see the famous Abraham Zapruder home video of the assassination. Anthony Summers is an award-winning author who has investigated and written extensively on the assassination of Kennedy. He was talking on the subject earlier in the week to the Parnell Summer School. He joins me now from our Cork studio. Anthony, good morning to you.
Good morning.
People listening will say, come on, there's nothing new to be said about the Kennedy assassination. But material is still emerging. For example, what Jacqueline Kennedy said at the time of the assassination.
Yes, perhaps it's meat enough after the introduction with the CBS broadcast of the moment that Kennedy was shot to reflect on what Jacqueline Kennedy herself said in an interview with Life magazine just a week after the assassination, an interview that was suppressed until very recently. I got hold of the text just a month or two ago. And what she said was, you know, when he was shot, he had such a wonderful expression on his face. Then he looked puzzled. He had his hand out. I could see a piece of his skull coming off. It was flesh-coloured, not white. He was holding out his hand, and I can see this perfectly clean piece detaching itself from his head. And then the limousine gathered speed, and Mrs. Kennedy believed she cried, "I love you, Jack." I kept saying, "Jack, Jack, Jack." All the way to the hospital, I kept bending over him, saying, "Jack, Jack, can you hear me? I love you, Jack." I kept holding the top of his head down, trying to keep the... And she couldn't finish the sentence.
And that was suppressed at the time. I suppose you can see why in retrospect.
I think Life magazine simply thought it was too strong meat for the American public.
Yeah. Your interest in the case goes back a long, long time, several decades, and you have trawled through reams upon reams of material. You have interviewed hundreds of people over the years. But the evidence...
If I may just intervene, I wanted very much to stay away from the case through the 60s. I was a student when it happened and working part-time in the vacations because I'd run out of money for Granada's World in Action program, which had just started at that time. And I was actually asked to go to Dallas on the day until they phoned back and said they'd found somebody with more experience. And in the end, I was rather relieved because as the jokers and charlatans came out of the woodwork on this story, and it seemed to me a story into which journalists' reputations sort of vanished without trace. I was glad to stay away from it, but I did a documentary for the BBC's Panorama programme, of which I was an assistant editor, in the late 70s, when the House Assassinations Committee, that's a congressional body, returned a verdict of probable, unfortunate word, but probable conspiracy, which of course was the absolute opposite of what the Warren Commission had ruled, which is that Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin, had done it all on his own. And in the course of making that documentary, I realized how very, very poorly the thing had been reported at the time and since by the media, especially the US media. And it was really that triggered my lasting interest.
And there's actually a specific piece of legislation which has brought a lot of material into the public domain. It was passed in 1992, the President John F. Kennedy Assassinations Records Collection Act. It's a bit of a mouthful, but that has brought a lot of material to us, hasn't it?
It has brought a lot of material to us. And of course, in a way, it's also, because millions of documents have been released, it's also confused researchers, which might be what some in authority would have liked, because there were so many millions of documents poured out of the archives, the great mass of them rather irrelevant to anything at all, that it's been very hard to get to the nub. Thinking back to your OMA item this morning, I think those working on the OMA case possibly would also agree that, you know, what layman and indeed what congressional investigator what are they going to do with such a multitude of documents? You'd need the funding, you need staff, you need a massive resources to work on such stuff. I think slightly more interesting is what we've learned about what we can't see. We've learned that Army intelligence and Secret Service documents have to some degree been destroyed, willfully destroyed, much to the upset of the Congressional Committee, that there's a number of naval intelligence documents, naval because the alleged assassin, Oswald, had been a US Marine previously. They've not been accounted for. And very specifically, 1,100 some CIA documents have been retained under the national security rubric. Now, if Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy on his own with his old Italian rifle, as the Warren Commission claimed, why is it that 50 years later there are still CIA documents that have to be retained under national security regulations? That is the sort of reason that people remain very sceptical.
I mean, that's the known unknown. That's what we know exists, but we don't actually have. There could be other things out there that we don't know exist. But let's talk a little bit about Oswald, the man held responsible, if you like, for the killing of John F. Kennedy, certainly held responsible by the Warren Commission. Before we get into the question of whether or not he was working alone, what was the evidence against Oswald? Because, of course, he never stood trial.
He didn't, because he was shot dead a day or two later by Jack Ruby. Of course, the Warren Commission had a great deal of evidence that pointed to the dead Oswald, who couldn't go to trial because he was dead, that pointed to his guilt. He had the means. He had an old Italian rifle, which was found in the building in which he worked, to the rear of the president's motorcade. And he had the opportunity. He was there in the building at the time. So he had means, opportunity, but not that crucial thing, motive. It was always a weakness of the official investigation that no one could figure out any reason why Oswald would have wanted to kill President Kennedy. To the contrary, he was on the record with numerous people as having said that he liked President Kennedy, or that certainly he didn't think that any successor to President Kennedy would be better in terms of his policies than Kennedy had been. So it didn't make any sense.
We do know that he claimed to have been in a downstairs lunchroom in the Texas Book Depository at the time. Were there witnesses who were prepared to support that story?
Yes. And I got the first interview with one of them, who had been secretary to a senior official in the book depository at the time. I found her a very credible person. She was a woman called Caroline Arnold. It was a memorable day for her because she'd been very pregnant, just about to have her baby, and she'd gone back from the street where she was standing with some woman friends into that downstairs lunchroom. She knew Oswald. She gave him wages and change each week. She said she caught a glimpse of him sitting in one of the booths in the lunchroom. Now, that itself is odd, of course. Why wasn't, if Oswald was in the lunchroom, one wonders why he wasn't like everybody else watching the parade. But Caroline Arnold's evidence and the evidence of two other people who were actually in the lunchroom indicates that Oswald was there at least as late as 12:25. Now, the president had been due to go past the depository at 12:25. In fact, the motorcade was 5 minutes late and he didn't go past till 12:30. But would a would-be assassin have been sitting, loafing around, calmly eating his sandwiches in the lunchroom when he was due to shoot a president who was about to go back go by at 12:25?
Now, okay, we come to the question then of let's assume that Oswald was involved, but was he there alone? Was he solely responsible for the assassination of Kennedy? Just talk about the famous Zapruder film and how the Zapruder film suggests that there was more than one gunman.
Well, you mentioned Dan Rather earlier. This, of course, Dan Rather is a very respected, now retired, American frontman on television. He was a young newsman at the time, and he had what for years remained the only exclusive access to the Zapruder film, which he saw when the police and the FBI were viewing it right after the assassination. He went on air and said, you see, that at the last shot, the president jerks forward. And he just got it wrong. I think it was an innocent mistake, not a deliberate thing. But in fact, you see the president jerk violently backwards. Anyone who remembers seeing the Zapruder film, which wasn't going to be released for some 20 years, knows that. And of course, to the layman, it makes it look as if the president was shot not only from behind where Oswald was or where a shooter was, but from in front. And in fact, the Congressional Assassinations Committee came to the conclusion that there had probably also been a shot from the front. And so in the, just in the last year or two has the National Livermore Laboratory, which is a nationally respected organization in the United States, has come to the same conclusion. But look, it's this whole case, one should know, is a muddle. Again, I make the analogy with the Oma bombing. In a different sort of way, this thing is an absolute mess. The autopsy was messed up from the beginning. One of the doctors involved in the autopsy was more equipped to deal. He had veterinary experience, for God's sake. The president's brain is missing. We're talking about gunshot wounds to the head here. The president's brain went missing and is still missing. The whole thing is a mess, which, not necessarily or deliberately, but out of sheer inefficiency in the middle of that horrendous national tragedy. In fact, there is evidence when you plow through this massive amount of material, and I've tried to explain it as simply as possible and expand it in a new edition of my book, Not in Your Lifetime, there is evidence that evidence, witness testimony, none of it very clear, but there is the suggestion that, in fact, there was a conspiracy, and that conspiracy came from the anti-Castro Cubans who were who felt betrayed at the time by Kennedy's policies over Castro's Cuba, and perhaps also from mobsters who were suffering the biggest onslaught that they ever had. Mobsters, I'm talking about the mafia, from the Kennedy administration.
The likes of Traficante, for example, who's
the likes
frequently.
Of Santo Traficante and Carlos Marcelo.
I remember some years back interviewing Oliver Stone. I think it was at the time of the release of the film JFK, and I challenged him on a couple of the issues raised in the film, and he accused me of being an advocate of Anthony Somers. how do you feel about Oliver Stone and about the theory advanced in JFK?
Look, I know Oliver Stone, and I like Oliver Stone. He's a movie maker, and I saw him just a few months ago. And we talked, as we always talk a little, about the JFK movie all these years later. And he said, well, it was good theatre. He did claim at the time that he was making it according to the facts.
That the military-industrial complex got Kennedy because he was about to pull out of Vietnam.
I think the serious thing is that a film like that that persuaded a whole new generation that the assassination happened in another way simply wasted time when there was still time for real investigation, when the Congressional Assassinations Committee chief counsel felt that had the Justice Department in the United States got hold of it after that congressional committee's work and pursued a full and proper investigation, that people could still have been put on trial for the assassination of President Kennedy. And enormously powerful films like the JFK movie simply diverted attention in other directions and diverted the attention of the population and indeed turned the Kennedy assassination into something of an entertainment, which it isn't. It really isn't. It's a national trauma that should have been resolved in the same way that the Omagh bombing should have been, and one suspects, listening to your interviewees this morning, could have been resolved.
I'd love to talk to you for a lot longer. Unfortunately, time, Anthony, has caught up with us. But you do have the extensively rewritten conspiracy, retitled. It's now called Not in Your Lifetime, which I think is a quote from Warren himself in 1964 when he was asked about the information coming out, the information we made public. And he said, yes, there will come a time, but not in your lifetime, he told the reporter. So we look forward to seeing that in the autumn. Anthony Somers from our Cork studio, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you.